This series is brought to you with the kind support of Wellington Management, one of the world's largest independent asset managers. Wellington believes in the importance of a diverse workforce, equitable opportunities for all colleagues to reach their potential, and an inclusive culture.
I distinctly remember flying up to Billings, Montana one day, and I ended up being there for 13 days and spending a lot of time with this one technician out there, Holm John. He and I spent 16 hours a day working together trying to solve a problem. And you get to know people when you're that close for that long. And so we talked about our families, we talked about our interests, our pets, where we lived, the cities we were from. And every time I would mention my husband, Will, who at the time was my boyfriend, John would misgender him. It's as if he just couldn't hear the word boy at the before friend. You know, I'd say, oh yeah, my boyfriend and I live in Pilsen. It's a neighborhood in Chicago. There's a lot of great food there. This is what we enjoy doing. We love to travel. And he'd go, oh, what's your girlfriend do? And I'd say, oh, well, my boyfriend, Will, he's a graphic designer and he works here and this is what he does. And he'd go, oh, that's cool. How long have you known her? I had to stop him at one point. I just said, hey, John, I'm not upset with you. And I don't think that you're doing this on purpose, but I'm gay and my boyfriend's name is Will. But yeah, that was an interesting experience having to kind of not be seen when you're not hiding. I was used to not being seen when I was hiding, but it was very interesting to not be seen when you're standing right in front of somebody.
Ethan Devitt, and welcome to this 50 Faces Focus series, in which we are celebrating LGBT professionals in a special series for Pride Month 2022. I'm joined today by Chas Manning, who describes himself as being passionate about people and data. He obtained a degree in manufacturing engineering from Boston University and has held a series of engineering and operating roles, with some twists and turns in between. He lives with his husband Will and two dogs in the Oak Park area outside Chicago, and we are in fact neighbors. Welcome, Chas. Thanks for joining me today.
Thanks, Ethan. Good to be here.
Well, let's start with talking about your background. Where did you grow up and what were your early interests?
I grew up in Boston, child of a single mother, and I really cared a lot about play. I think play was important to me as a child, going out and doing things that were interesting, whether that was learning a new video game or a new skill. I played a lot of music, tried every sport you could imagine, and just really worked on figuring out my place in the world, which I'm still working on.
Well, certainly, if our Halloween celebrations are anything to go by, you certainly haven't lost that playfulness. So thanks for sharing that. And now let's talk about your career journey. So how did you end up seeing yourself interested in engineering and then how that career took you from engineering into operations?
In high school, I went to a all-male private Catholic Jesuit high school in the Boston area. And it was an interesting environment as a young gay kid trying to figure out their place in the world. I was just told, you know, you're good at math and science, you should be an engineer. And I think for a lot of folks in my cohort and age group, that was something we were told a lot. We were kind of sent in a direction and said, hey, this is what you're good at, go do that forever. And so that's what really got me interested in engineering initially. You know, it was a career journey that through college, I could figure out where specifically I wanted to be in that space and then go from there. And so I actually enrolled at BU as an electrical engineer because I had taken physics and thought that was fun. And so in my time at BU, I really shifted pretty quickly into manufacturing. I took an introductory course from Professor Ted DeWinter on manufacturing. And it was really the culmination of people and processes within engineering, because a big part of manufacturing historically has been the people who do the work. And so that's where my interest in kind of people operations and data and process planning really came from, is that initial course way back in my freshman year of college. So that first semester, I changed my major to manufacturing and didn't look back. Finished up the 4 years with, after doing some internships and working in some groups in a variety of spaces, I ended up really enjoying the operation side of things. So I was recruited to join Praxair, now a Linde company, in their operations management leadership program, where I moved out to Los Angeles, having never been to California, and learned how to manage people very quickly, trial by fire, if you will. So that's really where that pivot from engineering specifically from a technical standpoint to people management and operations management happened right away after school. And I realized that going and getting a degree in engineering primarily just proved that I knew how to learn and knew how to learn things quickly rather than I knew how to do anything specifically. And I feel like that's pretty common in a lot of professional career path programs in college, that you're not taught anything specific, but you're taught how to learn a lot of things so that when you're thrown out into the real world, you can realize that none of the stuff specifically that you learned in college can typically be directly applied. So you have to learn how to figure it out along the way, I think is really where that came from for me.
Learning how to approach problems, absolutely, and not necessarily coming with a book of knowledge. For someone who's passionate about data, this must be a great time to be alive. How are you coping with the massive increase in the amount of data we have to work with now?
Yeah, I think the biggest challenge is knowing what data is good data and making sure that you're collecting data in a way that will lead you to make reasonable decisions. I think the biggest challenge I have is convincing folks that data is important and that the investment in collecting that data before you make a decision is important. Because oftentimes you approach an issue or a problem and folks look at it and they say, I know exactly how to solve this. Let's go do it. And that's great in a lot of ways, but can be influenced a lot by biases within that space and influenced a lot by what someone's individual experience is and who they believe the customer is or what the customer wants, rather than looking at empirical collected data. What did the customer say they wanted is something that I think is really challenging at times to explain to folks how important the data collection method is rather than just the outcome that you come from that.
And moving from the customer to the team you work with, you've managed both teams and projects. Do you have any kind of secrets to how to successfully manage a team or run a project? Any kind of heuristics or preferences that you have in terms of approaching that?
Yeah, I like to approach management of both teams and projects and working together primarily from communication. So you start with communicating with each other. The first project I was given in my operations program out in Los Angeles with Praxair was to manage a team of chemists by influence. So I had 18 folks working with me in the lab out at a specialty gas plant in Los Angeles. And I wasn't their direct manager. We had a lab manager who was focused on things, but I was brought in from an operations and procedural standpoint to kind of help the team become on time. When I showed up, the on-time percentage for an order was 18%. So in context, if you placed an order on Amazon or a website and they said, hey, we'll get it to you in a week, only 18% of the time did that actually show up in a week. And we were really bad at communicating with the customer as well about those delays and what would happen. And so over the course of 6 weeks with working with this team, we went from 18% to 96% on time using a spreadsheet and a daily meeting. So communication was key there. There wasn't a huge technological solution. There wasn't a huge infrastructure spend that needed to happen. We didn't have any capital expenditure to make this happen. And we actually reduced labor costs because people were working more efficiently. And it wasn't because I came in with a special set of knowledge of how to properly demand, plan, and schedule the order selection that was happening. It was simply having a meeting as shifts change and said, hey, what'd you work on today? What are you planning to get done the rest of the day? And do you have any blockers or things in your way? So very simple communication styles and prioritization led to a remarkable increase in the customer experience, our on-time percentage, our employee satisfaction and engagement all went up. And so everybody ended up winning by just having a simple meeting. It's surprising how far communication can get you when you're trying to solve problems that seem insurmountable.
And it's also surprising, I think, how obvious it is, but yet how often it's missed, how often communication is inadequate or just simply not done. And across all businesses, it never ceases to surprise me. And you've had some twists and turns in that career as well. Can you talk about that? You haven't always stayed within an engineering or manufacturing environment.
Yeah, I've moved around a bit. I think my career has come a long way in the last few years, specifically through COVID. A lot of things have changed. But coming out of Praxair after 3 years working at a large corporation, I wanted to find a place that I felt I could make a direct impact and influence on the culture and find a place that really cared about their employee culture in a deep way. And so at the time, my now husband, Will, was working for startups and he was having a great cultural experience. He felt valued. He felt like his voice was heard. At that point, I started looking elsewhere. So I took a pretty significant pay cut. I took a 30% pay cut, gave up all of my benefits to go jump out of the corporate engineering world and into startups. And so this is probably 8 years ago now, I went and worked for my first startup, managing a fleet of drivers delivering healthy food on demand in the Chicagoland area. From there, I ended up running a vacation rental company. So I was the COO of a vacation rental company based out of Chicago, but with offices in six other cities. So I was traveling weekly. I lived in Nashville for about a month, launching that city and hiring the folks there. And so after a few years in the startup space, I found myself working in a software company focused on mental health. I felt really good about doing that role because as opposed to just working to make somebody else money or provide a great customer experience, there was a little heart to it, right? We were working with veterans dealing with PTSD and anxiety and depression and working through a program to through the VA to provide them with a mental health care resource. While I was there kind of getting interested in the healthcare space, I was approached and poached, if you will, to go run a women's healthcare center. So I'm a huge fan of learning a variety of things. I'm a natural lifelong learner. I mentioned before that being in an engineer, all I really learned in school was how to learn things quickly. And so I kind of have a voracious appetite for knowledge. I'm the person in a meeting who's never afraid to throw their hand up and say, hey, I don't know what that acronym means or what that word is. And that just leads me to learn things quickly. And people trust and understand that when I'm asking a question, it's for my own ignorance, not because I'm trying to challenge them. I found in other places, people will not necessarily always have that trust in their leaders and their teams. And in this case, I moved into women's healthcare. So I became the COO of a women's healthcare center here in Illinois and grew that business aggressively through COVID. So I started there in 2018, so about a year before COVID hit us. And fortunately, we had done a lot of improvements to grow our ability to work together in a communicative way and in a way that wasn't small, specific office space. So what we had done there is really focused on utilizing and leveraging technology to improve our communication systems amongst each other, as well as our communication with our patients. We called them guests. We wanted folks to have a really hospitality-focused experience because a pap smear is not necessarily an enjoyable experience. It's just a necessary one. So what can we do to make that experience as comfortable as possible? So silk robes, fur on the stirrups, an offer of a mimosa on a Saturday morning with your appointment were the kinds of things we did to just kind of lower the barrier of comfort to make it just that much easier for folks to be comfortable coming into the Wright Center for Women's Health there. So I worked there for 2 years through COVID. We pivoted to telemedicine and grew our staff by 50% and our size by 50%. And after a few years there, I took some time off and I took 6 months for myself to figure out what I wanted to do next, because I, for a long time, had found myself in positions with startups of leadership without a lot of guidance or direction from above. And I've always been hungry for mentorship. And so in a role where I can learn, I want to be able to learn from someone, not just necessarily from the experiences that are flying at me. And so I'm really happy where I am now in project management, helping make an organization run smoother and in a way that allows them to grow swiftly, but also sustainably. So actually today is a month that I've been with Painters USA as a project manager, and it's been a great experience working with them to identify areas of improvement and build and bring structure to their project management. So that's a focus of mine right now, is helping build out our project management office and our processes and procedures so that as we continue to grow, both geographically and just in numbers, that we have the capability to support internally our teams out in the field.
Well, there's quite a lot there. And I have to say, my ears kind of pricked up when I heard about your initiatives in the women's health clinic. It sounds like that's the kind of clinic I need to go to.
Yeah. I highly recommend it.
A memory I have is when I had one of my children at Northwestern Hospital in Chicago using the term to the nurses that I was going to check out of the hospital the next day and not be discharged. So I think clearly that hospitality experience had been successful with me. But let's move on now to talk about, this is obviously a Pride special podcast, and we have a lot of focus on LGBT inclusion in different professions, as well as diversity overall. And I'd love to hear about your own experience. You mentioned already at the high school level, your experience as a gay man or teenager at that point. Can you just tell us a little bit about your own experience in terms of the age you came out and what that was like in Boston at the time?
Yeah, so see, I'm 32 now. I came out at 14. So it's been more than half my life, which is interesting to think about. So yeah, 14 years old, a freshman in high school. I came out for the first time to some friends and it didn't go great in 2004. It was the kind of experience where folks just weren't ready for it, but oversharing 14-year-old me was just trying to feel close to people. And I think that figuring out how exactly my identity fit in with the world was something that was challenging. So I essentially had to come out twice. Came out at 14, went back in the closet. And then for me, the big ability to transition into, you know, who I wanted to be in the world was transitioning to college. So going to BU, I distinctly remember at orientation meeting somebody who I just thought that they were fully and authentically themselves. And I used that as license or permission, if you will, to do the same. It was a fresh start. I didn't know many people going to school there. There are 4,000 folks in an incoming class my year. And so one or two of them I may have known prior to college, but really being able to kind of create and craft my own identity from scratch for the first time was really exciting. I got to choose what people's experience of me was and not be kind of put into a bucket or space for that. So I started college out and proud. I had to come out a lot, but most of the time it wasn't surprising because it was just a conversation that identifying a label, right? It didn't change who I was to folks. It didn't change the relationship we had. It was just a, oh, by the way. And it was very supportive. I don't think I've had a single negative coming out experience in retrospect. At the time, some of them have been uncomfortable or painful, but in the end, it's about figuring out for myself what I needed in that moment or from that relationship. I'm thinking of a few specific experiences where it was the reaction I got or the response was not necessarily what I was looking for. If anything, it was just a piece of data for me to evaluate their relationship and understand what part do I want to play in the world, but also what part do I want that person to play in my life if it's not a positive experience.
You did tell me a funny story about one of the workplaces you were in where you had to come out multiple times with the same person. He just seemed to not acknowledge or want to acknowledge what you told him. You've worked in so many different workplaces across the country, in some probably less liberal areas than where we live. Can you talk about how your experience at work has been being out?
After college, I had another decision to make. How do I want to live my life professionally? I just spent 4 years without my identity as a gay man being particularly relevant to my life. And suddenly it felt incredibly relevant. I was moving to a new state. I was moving to a new city and determining what I wanted to present to the world. It was kind of another opportunity to reinvent oneself and decide, is the way I've been living my life the way I want to continue? It's a natural inflection point. Again, moving to a new place in a new environment with folks you don't necessarily know, there's a lot of options there. So I remember getting to Los Angeles in the first few months, not being sure how to include my identity at work. I had made a pretty conscious decision, mostly out of fear, to keep my personal life very separate from my work life. I was in very liberal Los Angeles. I lived in West Hollywood, but the plant that I was working at was not in one of the most liberal communities of Los Angeles County. And so working with folks who have a different background than me and have different expectations and experiences in the workplace is just much easier for me to not navigate that right away. I never lied, but I just withheld. And so when folks would say, hey, what are you up to this weekend? I would just say, oh, nothing much. Or if questions started feeling too personal or people invited me to things, I would say, oh, you know, I like to keep my personal and professional lives separate. And that was something that felt fine at the time. And I think came from a lot of historical guidance that folks who are different are kind of told to conform. And we're taught that through media, we're taught that through our experiences with other people. And so not having a lot of role models, having never actually seen someone professionally being queer and out, I decided I didn't want to be the one at my plant. until I decided I needed to be. And that came from mentorship with other folks. And so as I started becoming a mentor to people at work and helping them grow and succeed, I realized that I was doing both myself and the people around me a disservice by not being my full authentic self at work. And so I remember distinctly the Monday morning, I made the decision to go into my facility manager's office and let her know and kind of ask for some specific things, because there had been, I don't know, it's tough to describe, but in a manufacturing environment in South LA with a variety of different folks working together, it's not necessarily the most inclusive environment for someone who's different. And so there were some language that would be used regularly on the shop floor that I requested to no longer be said, and things like that, in terms of making sure that the workplace became more inclusive. That's really where my drive to share my identity came from. I wanted the space to be inclusive because I felt very quickly while I was there that there were periods of discomfort that needed to be addressed. And once I felt a responsibility for other folks in their journey, I felt it was important for me to live authentically at work as well. And so it didn't take long. It was about 6 months into my time there that I had this conversation and said, hey, here's some things that are going on that aren't okay and need to change. And here's why it's important to me. Not that you needed a gay person in the building to have people stop using slurs, but I think that it definitely made it more of a priority. So that was a great experience. From there, getting to see the shift and change and how attention was being paid to inclusivity in that workspace was really great to see. From there, after, you know, my first year in LA, Praxair actually moved me out here to Chicago, where I was a support engineer across the country. And so I kept a go bag under my desk, and I would get a phone call and be on a plane a few hours later. I distinctly remember flying up to Billings, Montana one day, and I ended up being there for 13 days and spending a lot of time with this one technician out there. We'll call him John. He and I spent 16 hours a day working together trying to solve a problem. And you get to know people when you're that close for that long. And so we talked about our families, we talked about our interests, our pets, where we lived, the cities we were from. And every time I would mention my husband, Will, who at the time was my boyfriend, John would misgender him. It's as if he just couldn't hear the word boy before friend. You know, I'd say, oh yeah, my boyfriend and I live in Pilsen. It's a neighborhood in Chicago. There's a lot of great food there. This is what we enjoy doing. We love to travel. And he'd go, oh, what's your girlfriend do? And I'd say, oh, well, my boyfriend, Will, he's a graphic designer and he works here and this is what he does. And he'd go, oh, that's cool. How long have you known her? I had to stop him at one point. I just said, hey, John, I'm not upset with you. And I don't think that you're doing this on purpose, but I'm gay. And my boyfriend's name is Will. And the reaction to that was surprise, shock, in the sense that I think he immediately felt embarrassed. And to me, I'm like, he had no reason to feel embarrassed for mishearing me or not noticing or recognizing that I'm queer. But I think his shock and fear was from my new perception of him in saying that. So his first response was, oh, I'm not prejudiced. I'm sorry. And I just had to stop him before we got too far down the self-pity party, if you will. But I was like, hey, John, it's totally fine. I'm not upset with you. I just don't want to have to keep correcting you. For me, it was just a part of the conversation and was not really particularly impactful. I thought it was more funny than it was problematic. But I wonder if I could reach out to him now and find out if that changed anything for him, or if that adjusted how he approached the world. But I spent 13 days with him and then didn't speak again. So I wouldn't know. But yeah, that was an interesting experience, having to kind of not be seen when you're not hiding. I was used to not being seen when I was hiding, but it was very interesting to not be seen when you're standing right in front of somebody.
Well, I think probably a common experience of many underrepresented groups, not being seen when they're standing right in front. It's probably an image I've heard more than once on this podcast series. But it is kind of amusing that anecdote you told. I suppose you have to see the funny side, or otherwise it would just be too depressing. When you just look today, maybe at the scorecard of workplaces you see, and you probably see a lot of them through your network and the work you do, what kind of score do you give workplaces today in terms of how inclusive they are?
I've been really fortunate over the last, you know, most of the last decade to work places that are, you know, in emerging fields or smaller businesses or groups. You know, in the startup space, the startup spaces I've worked in are the most representative that I've seen, specifically for LGBTQ plus, or just, I use the banner queer for myself, queer folks. It's definitely some of the most inclusive and diverse spaces I've seen. So I've been really fortunate in that. I think that that environment draws people who are looking for that to them, because they are just seen as a more flexible environment to begin with. I haven't worked somewhere with a dress code for quite a while. And so having that space has been really refreshing to kind of figure out who I am and my place in the world. But Praxer did a really good job of caring too. When I moved to Chicago, I helped found our LGBTQ resource group. I got involved in recruitment through that and the campus level, as well as attending conferences through Out in Equal Workforce Summit, working on making sure that our organization completed the Human Rights Campaign Corporate Equality Index survey and working to make those policies inclusive. I think they did a good job of that. They scored highly. They were making an investment. But culturally, I don't know if that really trickled throughout the organization. It's challenging when it's a company that's global and has thousands and thousands of employees to ensure that the culture of, you know, a regional office is trickled out to the field. And so that was one of the reasons I realized it was kind of time for me to try something new, was that I didn't know how much impact I could have even as a leader there, because I didn't see any others. There wasn't a lot of visibility. And I think that's the metric that I kind of care about most, is it's visibility. And by visibility, I don't mean, do you have someone who's willing to have you out them on your board, right? Do you have someone in leadership who has a spouse of the same gender as them, right? It's not about just checking the box. It's also about, I think visibility is more about presence. It's about action and appreciation. And so seeing folks who are able to live authentically at work, regardless of their identities and their intersectional identities that come from that, is the most important thing to creating an inclusive work environment for queer folks and for everyone. I think that nobody loses when you let people be themselves at work.
I love that as one of the words of wisdom I'll take from this podcast. And you certainly, Chaz, are one of the most authentic people I know. So whatever you're doing, it's working. And thank you for raising awareness and for the visibility you're bringing. So when you look back at the course of your career and life in general, have there been any key people who've made a particular impression on you?
Yeah, definitely. I think that the largest person who's made an influence on my career and life in general, but career specifically, is my husband, Will. He's the one that introduced me to the startup space. He's the one that made me see that there was more than just your corporate career. I had planned all through college to find a job at a large company that I could move through different departments and try new things. And I found that. But culturally, what I was missing was what I didn't know I was missing until I met Will and we started talking professionally. He's the person that I spend the most time talking about work with. We come home and we hit the how was your day kind of questions, and we go from there. He also really introduced me to the way software project management and product development works, which has influenced my working style as well in non-software projects. And so having someone whose experience and knowledge and approach to work is different than mine to kind of discuss problems, challenges, and highlights, and then also having that person in my house that I can talk to whenever I need to, has been incredible. Over the last 9 years that we've known each other, I think the most growth I've had professionally has come through brainstorming and talking, comparing notes with Will.
My last question is around any words of wisdom, maybe in addition to that, or any advice you might have for your younger self. Is there anything that you can share there?
I think the big thing for me is what I've thought about a lot. I mean, thank you for those comments about me being authentic. It's something that is not easy. Being authentic is not an easy thing to do. And I think that oftentimes in our media landscape, we say authenticity is about oversharing or being brutally honest. And I don't necessarily agree with that. I think that for me, authenticity is about being true to who you are and who you want to be. And that's something for me that I've really taken a lot lately. When I think about what I want to do or a decision I have or a direction I want to go, I ask myself, what would the person I want to be do in this scenario? What would the parent I want to be to future children do? or who would I want that person to be? And then I try to move in that direction with my actions and my words. And so I think for me, when I think about creating space for other people, it's about being your authentic self and encouraging others to do the same. And so some advice I'd have for my younger self is listen sooner. I learned pretty quickly how to be authentic, but I didn't learn how to make space for others to do the same. And so listening sooner and learning how to actually listen to folks without just caring about a response is something that I wish I had learned a little sooner. But yeah, I think that there's a lot of really good literature out there as well. I've learned a lot from reading and listening to authors on the subject in terms of working with folks and being open and honest and making space for people to be authentic, but also help them grow. I learned a lot from Radical Candor by Kim Scott. I've learned a lot about self-discovery through reading and listening to some Brené Brown stuff about recognizing and acknowledging fear and shame, and then determining what you're going to do with it from there. So those are two authors whose works I've gotten a lot from that can give better advice than I could to folks.
Well, thank you so much. Not only, as I said, are you a very authentic person. You said it may not be easy, but you make it look easy.
And
certainly you're one of the best neighbors we could ask for. So thank you so much, Chaz, for coming here, for sharing your joy and your perspective and insights with us.
Well, thank you for the invite, Ethan. It was really a great conversation. I appreciate it.
I'm Ethan Devitt. Thank you for listening to our 50 Faces Focus series. If you liked what you heard and would like to tune in to hear more inspiring professionals and their stories, please subscribe on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts.
This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be construed as investment advice, and all views are personal and should not be attributed to the organizations and affiliations of the host or any guest. 'Cause I was made to be free.